Then we're picking up in Revelation 17. We're finishing our verse by verse through here as part of concluding our heads and horns study, which is a pretty lengthy side study from our Revelation 13. And so without trying to recap, as it were, or review, we're just going to continue to move forward because we've done that a few times now on this chapter. So, Sister Roseanne, could you read for us in Revelation 17 verses 9 and 10, please?
Revelation 17, 9 and 10. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. They are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue a short while.
Okay, thank you. Did you have any opening comment on that?
The seven heads and the seven mountains. Let me see. We know that. I know it, but it's so hard for me to kind of get all my thoughts, you know, to explain it.
Well, don't rush.
I'm not okay. Good at that. I know for sure on verse 10, when we're talking about the seven kings, these are successive kings. Five has fallen, and we had the list. We went over the list last weekend. Last Sunday, they have already fallen. One is, which at that point it was Victor Emmanuel. We're looking at this in the sixth head view. And Victor Emmanuel, and he's the one that came and he took the papal states away from the papacy. And that was in the time frame of the 1870s. I believe we were talking about to the 1930s. This is Brother Russell's writing period. And then he is the one that has let us know on all this. And the other has not yet come. And I believe I think I may be done. It comes and continues for a short while. That's not the eighth. I'm just slipping on that seventh. I'm sorry.
Well, we're in the sixth, like you said, and so this would be the seventh, which is a short time, which form of government is the seventh head for a short time.
I'm going to get it. Oh, the seventh head is the Nazi and fascist regime.
Yeah.
That's the seventh head. And it does only come for a while because that's only from the 1930s to 45.
Yeah.
And follows, the eighth will follow that. Yes.
Very good. That's right on. Appreciate that. That's outlined it nicely for us. And so as we saw, the Revelator brings out that these seven heads, these seven forms of government that follow one after the other, they're mountains, showing that they are large over the empire, like the kingdoms, and the woman, the harlot, unfaithful church, beginning with the papacy and then her daughters later, they were in existence, and at times they were, the papacy was in control of the government. She would have been pictured as seated on the beast, which is a church-state government during the Holy Roman Empire. When she's not on the beast, she's sitting on the waters. And the waters here in this chapter are the people. So the people support her as a religious institution. And so with that, in our verse 10, which was just plainly explained, I'll just ask, is there any other comments on verses 9 and 10 here? Brother Adi.
It's just interesting that it says that he must remain for only a little while. And you would think it would say he will remain for only a little while. But the must indicates that it's that something has to happen and there's a result of, as of him reigning for only a little while. And my thought is that it was because of Hitler that the nation of Israel was founded. Over.
Oh, that's very interesting. That was certainly part of it. They were the severe hunters, in a sense, for sure. Okay, good. Brother Michael.
I was just thinking along the line of Brother Adi, that all of these events, how I know it's basically focusing on the church, but how did these events lead to the formation of the nation of Israel, or to the fulfillment of the restoration of Israel?
Because it drove the Jews back to the to have a homeland, because they realized that they were being exterminated in Europe, and they recognized that they had to get out of Europe, and they were being exterminated in Russia under Stalin, and they had to get out, and so that was part of it. Now, the groundwork had been laid in 1878 and continued, but that really was a great it was a huge prompter, for lack of a better word. Ruth.
Also, once the enormity of the Holocaust was revealed after it was liquidated by the West, the United Nations felt so horrible that they hadn't done anything to stop it, that they voted for partition and voted to give the Jews that area of Palestine over.
Yes.
1948.
May 1948, they were declared a nation by the United Nations. I think there was only three countries that abstained from that vote. Okay, very good. Sister Debbie?
I just had a question. I know that in that verse it says a short space. In the Young's it says time. And it's, I don't know, is that the same word as time when it talks about time, times, and a half a time? Is that the same Greek word? Because then a short space would be like 7 years, and that's almost on the money when Hitler was in power, what isn't it? But anyway, just a thought. I don't know if it's the same word, though.
I'm not sure. That's interesting. Thank you. Brother Mark, Sister Gina?
I was just going to make a comment that this is kind of like a repeat of those two verses that we read last week above it when they're talking about the seven heads. Now we're talking about seven kings, and we know on the heads are crowns, and maybe that's what makes them kings. But it'll be interesting to see how – I can't remember why – I mean, it's not the first time in the Bible that the Lord repeats things in his, you know, in the scriptures, but it'll be interesting to see what happens or how that plays out, I guess. Didn't want to sidetrack or anything, just wanted to throw that out there. Over.
Oh, yeah, no, that's a good point. We got the same in these two verses. We have seven heads, which I'm going to add the words, which are the same as seven mountains, which are seven kings. And then it shows how they were successive in nature. And this is contrasted with the next couple of verses, where there are ten horns, which are ten kings. And they can be at the same time. So we've learned that. But we'll also say that it's interesting that we go back to our verse 2. And it tells us that this harlot has committed fornication with the kings of the earth. So it's helping identify for us that some of these kings who had influence over the religious masses of Christendom, so-called nominal Christians, that the harlot had an illicit relationship with them. And that was particularly during their church state period of time, as we saw earlier. But this helps confirm it for us so that we can understand that. But any other comment on this, Sister Day?
Well, not on that, but I just wanted to say that I found in Revelation 12:14, time there is pahiros, and in the one we're in, it's not. It's oligos. So it's two different words.
Okay. Thank you for looking that up for us. And neither one is chronos. So, okay. Thank you. All right. Anything more on these two verses, 9 and 10? Okay. So, Brother Jeff, could you read for us here in Revelation 17, verses 11 through 14, 11 through 14?
The beast who once was and now is not is an eighth king. He belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. Ten horns you saw are ten kings who have not received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will wage war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will triumph over them because he is Lord of Lords and King of Kings. And with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers.
Okay, excellent. Do you have any opening comment, Brother Jeff?
No.
Okay. So, brethren, in looking at this verse 11, the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven and goeth into perdition or destruction. That takes us back to our earlier consideration in verse 8, 7 and 8. And in verse 7 and 8, we're told the mystery of the woman and the beast that carried her, which had the seven heads and 10 horns, the beast that thou sawest was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into destruction. The point is now it's telling us in our verse 11 that this beast is an eighth and it's of the seven. So all along the way, including in this chapter, we are continually told that there are seven heads. Seven kings, seven mountains. And we've talked about them, and the scripture has shown us these seven heads are successive. What does it mean that this is now an eighth and is of the seven? What does that mean? Brother James.
That it's a repeat of one of the previous seven. Over.
Oh, just before you go, and I would completely agree. And if it's taking us back to verses 7 and 8 being as descriptive as it was, which form of government do we think is being repeated?
Probably the when the woman was riding the beast, so that would be the... they call it the papal millennium. Of course, when they had papal states, that was their heyday. So that would make sense. Over.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Brother Norm.
Brother Rick, would this show the civil and ecclesiastical papacy and Roman government working together? As they did, as would that be the fifth head, where the church and state were very in control of everything done, whereas the other heads as you had brought out, the woman riding on the beast, usually worked through the civil powers and had to get permission and so forth. But under the fifth head, that was not so. I think it was the full control of the papacy and the Roman government. And, then that disappeared again. And then this will be a reinstatement, a cooperation of the two working together. I hope that's at least somewhat correct. Over.
Yeah. I think we have a little different alignment on the numbering of those forms of government or those heads. Brother Norm, I would favor that this would be the fourth head, Napoleon being the fifth, and Victor Emmanuel being the sixth, because it's the time frame of Brother Russell's writing, that angel who's showing this to us. But that's the only adjustment. Otherwise, I think your comment is the same. It's showing a church and state cooperative effort. And just before I call on the next hand, I just want to say one little thing. The papacy is a religious government of its own. The papacy is a religious government on its own, but it's not a government over the Roman Empire on its own. So the papacy has ambassadors. Right now, they call them nuncios. But the United States, we have an ambassador at the Vatican City, and so do many other countries. And so it's not that the United States isn't recognizing the papacy as a religion per se. They do. They acknowledge that, but they're acknowledging their government aspect. And they feel papacy, the papacy feels they're a theocracy. They feel they're a God government, God organized government. So all what we're saying is, and the reason I'm bringing that out is that when we talk about the papacy or the beast as a religious government, there is that on its own. The papacy is that on its own. But then when the woman is riding the beast, it's showing a aspect where it's when the papacy is controlling the empire government, like during the Holy Roman Empire, as the friends have said. And that's why in the 17th chapter, there's a unique feature where we have the beast and we have the woman as being separate. So it's showing us the harlot woman, both when she's in control of the empire government, the Holy Roman Empire period, and again as a repeat in the eighth head. But it's also showing us when the woman sits on the waters, when she's not in control of the empire government, the people support her who are Roman Catholic. So she's still supported. Okay, I hope that didn't confuse things. Ruth.
I was thinking it's the only head it could be to come back, because you're not going to have Constantine come back. You're not going to have Napoleon come back. The Nazi fascist regime is over. Victor Emmanuel is gone. But the papacy is still here as the woman, or the Catholic Church as the woman. So it's the only one that can come back, really, realistically. Over.
No, it makes perfect sense to me. Thank you. Brother Adi.
Just a question. Do we believe, I mean, the papacy had control over primarily Europe, do we believe that they will have control of the whole world, or even America and China and Korea and all the other Asian countries? I know it says that it makes everyone worship the beast. But do we see that there will be a direct government rule of papacy over these other countries? Over.
Okay, very good. So thank you, Brother Adi. That's another one of these features in this chapter that we include. And that is, it's this chapter that helps identify in verse 5 that this harlot woman, Babylon the Great, has daughters, the mother of harlots, plural, and abominations of the earth. And that's where we've learned that Babylon the Great includes papacy first and foremost, but it includes the Protestant systems which have adopted much of papacy's character, wanting to be united and influence governments, adopting the Trinity, the Hellfire, and the various other godless honoring doctrines. And we are told in other places, so bear with me, we're told in other places that the image of the beast, Revelation 13, the image of the beast will be vitalized by the two-horned beast. The image of the beast with the Evangelical Alliance, a group of Protestants who united, 1846, and the two-horned beast is the Church of England. And when they get united in the future, it vitalizes the image of the beast, and they're going to cause everyone to either go along and get a mark of the beast in their hands or their foreheads, or they're going to be killed, great and small. So we have that telling us, and I'm going to just add the interpretation to that, that it shows a time when the Protestant daughter harlots unite with the Church of England harlot, and they support the mother harlot papacy. So that together, Babylon the Great includes all the various denominations that have one mind to try to influence the government on what Orthodox Christianity is. And they'll try to silence any who oppose that and not receive of their mark. So that being said, I know you're familiar with those things. Brother Russell outlines it in the long foreword to the fourth volume. He outlines that. That's what we're going to get to in our chapter 13. We don't think that necessarily means that it includes every person living on earth. Brother Russell thought it had more to do with those who would claim to be Christian more or less. Supposedly, so-called Christian nations. He wasn't of the concept that this meant that all the Chinese are going to somehow come under a church-state government arrangement. But rather, we see here that it's the European picture, and it extends out to the European colonies, the formerly European colonies, countries in Africa that are Christianized, United States and Canada, Mexico, and other parts of the world that can fall under this aspect of being part of Babylon the Great in the sense of their nominal belief system. Well, that's pretty long to say all that, sorry. But food for thought. Now, I did see, Ruth, you had your hand up, I believe.
No, that was old. Thank you.
Old, sorry.
I had my hand
up. Sister Roseanne?
But you answered it. I was going to ask about the Buddhists and stuff, but you answered it.
Okay. Brother Adi, back to you on your question, and then we'll have Brother James.
Very good. That seems very realistic, what could happen.
Okay. Okay, good. Brother James.
No, thank you. I was just going to add that we had studied before with the four universal kingdoms pictured in Daniel. Not that we don't recognize there were other kingdoms in the world at the same time, Genghis Khan, whatnot, but God was always concerned about Israel and who was in charge of Jerusalem. So that was our parameters for understanding the four universal kingdoms before. So this is somewhat of an extension of that with the Holy Roman Empire, pagan and Holy Roman Empire, I guess, that being that fourth universal kingdom. So it would make sense that Israel was created a state by those kind of those European nations, which were outgrowth of the Holy Roman Empire, which started all that colonizing, you know, Spain and Portugal, of course, and it was their divine right in their mind. That was the papacy gave them the divine right to conquer these lands, South America and Central America and India and some of Indonesia. And, yeah, so it's just to give a little more detail on what you already said, but thank you. Over.
No, that's very good. I appreciate that. You know, brethren, again, this is kind of an aside, but many evangelicals preach a one world religion under a literal one man who is Antichrist in a literal temple that'll be built in Jerusalem is going to control the whole world. That's evangelical teaching. But that's contrary to scripture, as one other aspect of demonstrating it's not a one world government under this future Antichrist. Another aspect is when you and I have studied in Ezekiel 38, Ezekiel 39, we've learned that after Christendom has fallen, after Babylon the Great has fallen, that there are Islamists in nations that surround Israel, whom the Lord brings down against Israel as a final chastisement and cleansing of Israel from their reliance on the Western powers, so that a holy remnant of Jews who believe in God will be saved, and God will destroy the Islamic invaders. And this will be the last of the destruction necessary. And God will be glorified and magnified in the total complete destruction of Islam and its forces. So Christendom receives his first and harshest rebuke because they blasphemed his name and persecuted his children and misrepresented him and his son Jesus. That's what we're reading about in the Revelation. But we also read in the Old Testament, as I mentioned in Ezekiel, that we have God's vengeance upon the Islamics, the Islamists who come down against Israel in the end. So that demonstrates there will not be a one world government where all were under this one Antichrist. Okay, so I hope that helps a little bit. Okay, so then back to our verses here, I'm thinking. We have read in our verse 11, the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven and goeth into destruction. That's a church state system, including the harlot papacy and the harlot daughter's Protestantism, is part of a cooperative church state system beast. And the ten horns, which you saw, are ten kings, which have received no kingdom. It says as yet in the King James. I think that's probably left out. It doesn't hurt anything. It's still telling us that there are ten horns, are ten kings. They've received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. And these have one mind. Now, I just want to stop there a second. This, again, emphasizing, demonstrates that you can have 10 horns, or it might be more than 10, less than 10, but 10 is our composite number showing completeness. So you have the completeness of these lesser kings or civil authorities that are under this eighth form of church state government over the Roman Empire at large. We have 10 lesser kings, forms of civil power, civil governments, maybe like countries, like France, Italy, Germany, Austria, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, England, and so on, 10 lesser powers that cooperate as a church-state arrangement, overarching government, not unlike the current European Union. You're all familiar with the current European Union. It's a unionization of countries of Europe, similar to how the United States has a unity of states under one government. In Europe, it's the European Union. And I think they place their capital currently. I think it's in Brussels. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong on that. But nonetheless, it's not as quite as certainly not as cohesive as the United States, as individual states are, but rather these countries have formed an economic union, and there's certain other elements, but they each still have their own political processes, so that they have their own presidents or premiers that they elect in each of these countries. But you know, England pulled out with the Brexit, Britain exit of the European Union. You know about that. So whatever this eighth beast is like, it is similar to what we see in a European Union, even though we think it'll be broader and it will be more cohesive, probably because it will be facing greater threats to their existence than they are currently. And this will lead them to want to form a more restrictive form of government, of so-called Christian government. So that's yet to be seen, but this is what these scriptures are holding out. And have received no power as yet. Brethren have often said that these are kings that exist after 1914. These would be kings or civil governments after the time when the monarchies had fallen. Because you all remember in World War I, that's when the monarchies, for all practical intents and purposes, were removed. There are still a few, but they're of lesser importance now. So the Lord delivered Europe out from underneath this so-called divine right to rule of these ruling families, royalty. They're relatively figureheads. But this, so these kings are after the 1914, after World War I. They never had that kind of power like the royalty had in their heyday. But under this eighth form of government, this eighth head, apparently they are going to have much more dramatic power given to them. And that's what it tells us. They receive power as kings. In other words, as the kings during the time of the monarchy. Monarchies. And that they are going to be united in giving their power to support this beast, this church-state government. Now, you may remember in reading this, I believe it's in the second volume, where Brother Russell says it would not surprise him. He said us. It would not surprise us if we see a strong monarchy in this country, the United States, in the future. And y'all remember reading that? So striking. He makes that comment, but it's based on these type of scriptures where he was looking at the prophetic future and he was seeing that this is really what Satan would like to get back to, the kind of control over a larger mass, because it's easier for Satan to control a few than it is to try to control the many. Satan would like to get back to that. And God is going to apparently allow that in order to be part of a testing period. Verse 13, they have one mind, they give the power and strength unto the beast. And verse 14, these shall make war with the Lamb. And so we know the Lamb represents Christ. the land shall overcome them. This is showing a time in the future when this eighth head, this church state government, is going to be destroyed after it's empowered, because he is the Lord of Lords and he's the King of Kings, and it's the time for him to assume his authority. And they that are with him are the called, those who are called of God to become sons of his by being in copies of Jesus. This is be the church. They're chosen. These are the ones that were spirit begotten. These were the ones that were developed. And under testing, they're faithful. They're faithful to be of that little flock. So it demonstrates that this eighth head, these kings who support this eighth form of government, are going to make war against the Lamb, Jesus, by attacking his feet members. And these would be the final feet members. And they can only attack that which is of the flesh, because these kings are on earth. And so they can only attack the part of Christ who's on earth. And again, that would be his feet members. And because it states the Lamb will defeat them, we're saying it's the final feet members. Because once the church is completed, then the plagues will be poured out and Babylon will be destroyed. The church systems fall first, then the kings who were united to them. And then we read in chapter 18, the merchants, the civil, the financial powers also fall. But this is our, these are these verses here, that just an overview of that. Brother Michael.
Right. I apologize for taking you back to verse 12. I know you talked about the ten kings potentially being, you know, like what we have in Europe. But what's curious for me is where it says they receive authority as kings. What exactly does that connote? What does that tell us? Like, it's obvious that they're deriving their power. And based on that relation, it's how they now cooperate with the East. But my question basically is...
So, Brother Michael, I think I caught most of your comments, but you did freeze a little bit, and you got a little choppy on your audio.
Can you hear me now? Is this better?
Now you're better.
Okay. Let me just repeat. I was just saying, I apologize for that. My internet is a bit unstable. So what I'm just trying to understand is when you look at verse 12, it suggests to us that the kings, they got their authority, from somewhere. And what I'm just trying to understand is where did that authority come from?
Okay. No, good question. So if these kings, these 10 kings, are, let's call them like 10 countries, how does the leadership of those 10 countries, how do they get their power?
For now, from the people?
Pardon me, one more time.
For now, from the people.
Yes, right. So it seems to suggest to our minds that in the future, there is going to be enough fear among the people that they are going to turn or allow leaders, strong leaders, to have control in order to save them from their fears. In the fourth volume, Brother Russell presents the thought repeatedly that the fears of a financial collapse, an economic collapse, will be a large motivator in allowing people who normally would resist a strong government, but because of their fear of losing their money, their savings, their social security, their hospitalization, their medical, their jobs. They will allow a strong government to step in and say, we are going to take control of this current environment and offer security. There's also an element that brethren suggest. There's the fear of Islamic terrorism. There's the fear now of nuclear and biological war. There's the fear of, the fear of misinformation. There's the fear of losing your way of life. Now, I'm not political, but I think we all can recognize that in this country right now, in the past 6-7 years, we've seen a divide amongst the people over political ideologies that isn't just Republican and Democratic and independent. But there are, I don't want to say fanatics, but I want to say there are those with extremely strong opinions that have made formerly what was politics almost into a religious view, either with God or without God in their mind. So that there's a clash of societal proportions and aspects to the political environment today that is not what we've seen previously in this country. And that will undoubtedly increase. And there are signs of that in Poland and in Hungary and in Italy and in Germany and in France. So if you look at the world news when they, in those countries where they go through their election cycles, and you see what parties are making progress amongst the populace, you can see that a strong right, religious right aspect is making greater headway than in years past. Okay, I'll leave it there at that. Sister Debbie.
Just a question. Do you think papacy, you know, when you mention a economic situation, do you think papacy has enough money to help in situations with bank failures and that so that the governments would rely on papacy financially and therefore would give control? In that sense, just a thought, over.
Okay, well, as you asked it, I don't think the papacy has that kind of money, personally, but in Revelation, the 18th chapter, it divides it. We have the woman, we have the kings, and we have the merchants. And the merchants are all broken down, the seafaring men, the pilots, the captains, the company of ships, the sailors. It demonstrates that in this eighth head arrangement, in the Western world, and those who come under the influence of the papacy and the Protestants cooperating with these governments who want to have a strong government for support, that these merchants are part of that. So you have the money, you have the financial aspect, you've got the civil powers with the military might, and you've got the religious aspect. So the brethren have often thought that the reason the papacy and these other religious leaders would be used would be to be a pseudo moral authority over this government. And so the papacy with the Pope and such, they continually try to present themselves as the do-gooders and the representatives of the poor. And that's an element that you sometimes don't see in some of the government officials. And so the brethren have suggested that that might be part of this. Ruth.
I guess it's probably an obvious point, but everybody goes to see the Pope for some reason. As soon as they get in power, they go visit the Pope. And not just the United States. I mean, that's the first thing anybody, the presidents do, is go see the Pope and pay a visit. And the people, the leaders in Europe, and even I think Putin even went to see the Pope, didn't he?
Yep. Like,
why are you going to see the Pope? He's got some power over something that they know they need. And I don't know whether there's any financial deal. I mean, we don't know. All we know is that they think it's valuable to them. Otherwise, that's the only reason they're going.
Okay. Well, that's true. You can't deny that. That happens for sure. And he's been used as a broker between world leaders, and is currently trying to do that as well with this war in Ukraine. But with that, he has influence with 1 billion Catholics in the world at some degree. And if you have influence over 1 billion people to some degree, politicians and world leaders take note of that, because what's that? A seventh of the world's population under one head? So that's quite remarkable. Sister Debbie.
Yeah, I like that Ruth brought that out, because the Pope doesn't ever go see anybody. They always go see, and even the Queen of England went to see him in 2014, and it was a difficult situation. They were talking about that in the news. It was a difficult situation at that time because, you know, it's two religious heads meeting together, and it's not just a government leader visiting a religious leader. It's, you know, so they had difficulties with that. Some of the people didn't like it. But I think that no King of England ever visited the Pope until Queen Victoria's son, was it Edward? He's the first one that said, you know, that actually went to visit the Pope. And after that, the kings and queens of England. Don't know if Charles has gone yet, but I know he went when he was a prince in 2019. So anyway, no, the Pope doesn't go visit anybody unless it's like to visit, you know, like he went to Saudi Arabia to visit the country, but he didn't go to visit the religious leaders. So, and actually one of the Muslim leaders went to visit him. So over.
All right. Okay. We all have our opinions, and I think the most of what you, I would agree most with what you said, Sister Debbie, but he does visit different world leaders. And John Paul II was invited, and he was the first pope to come to America, and he addressed both houses of Congress. And he was invited by a senator to do that. And I'll call on you. I'll give you a follow-up. Just a second. Let me finish. And he has traveled to Israel, Palestine, in his mind. And he did travel to Cuba and to meet the Archbishop, the Patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church. So they do. He does move around in ways that as connecting links in the halls of power that is makes him unique as a religious leader. I mean, Billy Graham didn't have that. He spoke to presidents, but he didn't have the international prestige. And Princess Diana went and saw the Pope. We have one of the photographs of her all dressed in black with a black veil. So it is a peculiar thing. Sister Debbie.
No, I didn't say that he didn't go visit government leaders. It's religious leaders. He doesn't actually go to another religious leader's home. It's like you're saying the Russian, they went to Cuba. They didn't go, the Pope didn't go to Russia. So I've never heard of him actually go to a place which is the home of a religious leader to visit a religious leader. Not, you know, he goes all the time for government officials. Yeah. Over.
Well, again, I have a little different opinion, but that we'll just have to agree to disagree on that. Sister Carrie, please.
See if I can articulate this, but the point I think is that these undermining powers that are the horns or the final horns is that they are speaking from a moral, they're speaking for God, they say, and they're taking moral stances. So their focus isn't completely economic and business or infrastructure, but their issues are moral. And we have seen recently in years where there's a large amount of money being funneled through nominal church organizations to appointing judges in the court, and they work more now recently through court systems. And I'm wondering sometimes if we can mistake that we're looking for kings and lawmakers and rulers when we maybe the powers are being shifted to the courts through the church. Nominal church is starting to use these systems because they've seen that that's where the last decisions are being made. Over.
Well, we certainly can concur with that. The current Supreme Court is decidedly majority opinions have been supporting Christian, so-called Christian views. So we do think that's an element that all the political leaders are recognizing, that their appointment of judges and federal judges and Supreme Court judges and judges being elected at local levels, they're realizing more and more that those with religious views or those who don't want to try to influence the judicial systems at all levels. So that is an important element of this. Very good. Brother James.
Just for some anecdotal evidence of what causes government leaders to act like dictators, and that the that Pastor Russell was saying with financial and war influences, if you look at the history of executive orders for American presidents, of course, America having a long history, now a modern history of democracy, and an executive order is an act of a president that doesn't need any acceptance by any other branch of government, so they can just act on their own. And if you look at the history of executive orders, there's like, each president ranges between like about 200 or 300 per term that they serve. And the most though was Franklin Roosevelt. He had 3,700 executive orders, and that's because he dealt with the Depression. He was president in 1933, and so that they were in the heart of the Depression, and then of course with World War II. So when those financial and national security things come into play, even a democracy will give up its democracy in order to deal with those situations. Over.
Well, that's for sure, because we had example of that in our recent time, as you know, after 9/11, executive order locked down all sorts of things. And then this last COVID, that locked down a lot of things too. So we do, that's very true. The executive powers can use their powers in a very influential way for a relative short period of time, but with maximum effect. And that might be, these might be examples of what we're talking about in this, our verse 12. Ruth.
Well, just observing the world over the last 10 years, it's absolutely amazing to me what people will overlook in abuses if they're financially benefited. by the government. If they're better off financially, it's amazing what they'll ignore as far as immorality and abuses and illegality and all that. Over.
So true. So true. Okay. Very good. So what we'll do is we'll move into our verse. I'm just going to say, are there any other questions on our verses 11 through 14, or do we think we've got had a good discussion? Okay. So our next set of verses, Brother David Vickery, could you read for us in chapter 17 of verses 15 through 15 through 18, we might as well just complete it here.
Thank you. 15 through 18. And he saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest where the whore sitting, where the whore sitteth, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the 10 horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For the Lord, for God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will, to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast, until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman which thou sawest is the great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. Over.
Okay. Brother David, just an opening comment for us on that verse 15, please.
Previously at the beginning of today's study, you mentioned that the beast can ride either...
The woman?
The woman can either ride the beast or the waters. And the waters is composed of the people, multitudes, nations, and tongues, different tongues. So they are one of the factions of the riding of the woman.
Okay. Nope, that's good. That's good. Anyone else on verse 15? Okay, so this is a symbol we saw back in the 7th chapter, verse 9, where we talked about it. We're not going to go there, just mentioning that this is a repeat symbol in the book of Revelation, and it represents a variety of people, perhaps variety of tribes or variety of nations, countries, but it's demonstrating for you and I that the religious system of papacy and perhaps her harlot daughters might be extenuated in this. They are supported by many different people. And so as a religion, that's who supports them when they're not on the beast. And that opening of verse 15 where it says, and he saith unto me, again, it's this angel, messenger, which we interpreted as Brother Russell, that he in his writings has explained to us these symbols more or less. And us living now are looking back and trying to interpret these symbols that he helped us with in our current setting with the passage of history since 1916. And that's what we've been trying to do. And so this here has helped us. And I'll just repeat from verse 1. This is telling us that during the sixth head, during the sixth form of government, the harlot was sitting on the water. She was not sitting on the beast. So it was during the time of, we're suggesting the sixth head, Victor Emmanuel. The papal church was in existence, certainly supported by the people, but they were not in control of the empire government at that time. So he's just explaining that symbol for us. So then when we get into verse 16, now there's a further explanation. The 10 horns which you saw And here's always a bit of a debate. The King James has the word upon, saw the ten horns which thou saw upon the beast. Thee shall hate the whore. But the Greek is usually better rendered, and the ten horns which thou saw and the beast, thee shall hate the whore. So you could see that there's a bit of a distinction, but we think there's a way to harmonize that both can be true. The ten horns which you saw, we discussed, these are the ten civil powers that have for 1 hour, they have give their power unto the beast, under this church state government, they cooperate. And the beast itself, this would be the body of the people who are under that form of government. They're going to hate the whore. They're going to hate the religious system. They're going to hate the papacy as a religious influencer and by extension her Protestant daughters. And they are going to end up destroying her. And this is what we refer to, that as a result of the seven last plagues poured out, the truth exposing the hypocrisy of Christendom, that this is a time when the burned bundled tares, the nominal Christians, will be burned. They will no longer think they're Christian, and they are going to tear down the system in anarchy. And this is what Brother Russell was expecting, was that the greatest part of the Lord's great army would actually come from those who have been under the restraint of religious belief as nominal Christians. And when that's exposed, that was all wrong, then they're going to wreak their vengeance upon the very system that had been deceiving them and controlling them. Sister Debbie.
Well, one of the things that always puzzled me is why in verse 16, the Lord would say that they shall eat her flesh. I keep thinking about when Jesus said, my flesh is meat indeed, and my blood is drink indeed in that text. But why would the Lord say, eat her flesh? Over.
Okay, that's good. Now, there is an Old Testament story, and I don't mean that like it didn't happen, but there's an Old Testament story about someone getting their flesh eaten. Is anyone picking up what I'm thinking about? Brother David.
Jezebel.
Yeah. And who ate her? Who ended up eating parts of her?
The people within, I'm sorry, she was thrown out the window. And the dogs ate her, and I think there was just part of her head and hands left, but a terrible thing, but I think it's an allegory, but at the same time, there won't be anything left. That's the way I understand it. Thank you.
Okay, now you are thinking of that story exactly right, and we probably do well to read it a little bit. I'm trying to find it now. I believe it's back in 2 Kings, but anyone who locates the story about Jezebel, Queen Jezebel's demise, just go ahead and speak up because I'm looking down.
2 Kings 9:35 and 36.
All right, thank you, Brother Chris. So 2 Kings 9, and we are going to start a little earlier. So since you found it, Brother Chris, that means you're there, I believe. So could you start back in well,
30?
That's good, but I was just looking a little bit earlier for one other point. Well, I won't delay us there. Why don't you pick up in 30? That's great.
And when Jehu was come, Jehu was the king of Judah, to Jezebel heard of it, and she painted her face and tarred her head and looked out at a window. And as Jehu entered in at the gate, she said, "Had Zimri peace, who slew his master?" And he lifted up his face to the window and said, "Who is on my side? Who?" And there looked out to him two or three eunuchs. And he said, "Throw her down." So they threw her down, and some of her blood was sprinkled on the wall and on the horses, and he trode her underfoot. And when he was come in, he did eat and drink and said, "Go see now this cursed woman and bury her, for she is a king's daughter." And they went out to bury her, but they found no more than her skull and her feet and the palms of her hands. Therefore they came in again and told him, and he said, "This is the word of the Lord, which he spake by his servant Elijah, the Tishite, saying, in the portion of Jezreel shall dogs eat the flesh of Jezebel, and the carcass of Jezebel shall be as dung upon the face of the field in the portion of Jezreel, so that they shall not say, this is Jezebel."
All right, right on. So, Brother Chris, you'd like to go ahead and comment on that for us?
Well, this is our types and antitypes. So Ahab is her husband. He's the civil authority. And Jezebel is the religious element in this true story. So Jehu, the king of Judah, he comes in, and he seems like a man of religious fervor, and he's going to clean house here of the enemy of the Lord. Jezebel, of course, persecuting Elijah, and he comes in, and everybody recognizes him, and he commands that she gets thrown out of a window. She painted her face to, you know, just like in our she's putting her best face on, to show, you know, her glory, or to hide, you know, her real ugliness. And so they throw her out the windows. These eunuchs represent the, those that served her and were under her, and, servants that, you know, pampered her all these years, but now they turn against her and throw her out the window as, the civil element, a sudden civil element that's new to them, and obviously has the authority. And so, he just goes in and it's like, no big deal. There's no real feeling expressed here from Jehu. It's just like a function that he does. And then they go out and they find the woman, and, he does recognize that he's kind of recognizes that she was the king's daughter, as it were, and gives her some kind of recognition of power. But when they go to do her some honor, sort of from a distance bewailing her, in a sense, a revelation expression, there's nothing left of her but her feet and the palms of her hands. So an element of the type of walk she walked, and the things that she did through her works, the works of her hands, you know, representing Babylon and papacy. And the dogs, they were the ones that had eaten basically this body. And so the dogs, as we learn from Luke 16, are those that are not in a relationship with the Lord. In Luke 16, it's the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, and the dogs lick at Lazarus's wounds. The Lazarus is Israel, those that are not the Jewish leaders, as it were, the people that are in a relationship with the Lord. And the Christians, they're not, they haven't had an opportunity to come in, so they're sympathetic, but they're still not in a relationship or a covenant with them as of yet. So here, the fact that they were eunuchs and in a relationship with the queen. Now it's the dogs have eaten her, so they have reverted to burned tares. They realize they're not in a relationship. And so that's all I got on that. Over.
All right. Very good. Very, very well put. All right. Thank you. Brother David.
Brother Rick, I like Brother Chris's approximation of all that. And I also just wanted to add that with just the feet, the skull, and the hands, there was no body. There's no, they can't put it back together again. It's just impossible. And it's a terrible picture, but a very apt picture. Over.
That's true. By those items remaining, if she had been completely eaten, they might have said, where'd she go? But with these items remaining, they could identify it as her. And we also remember the mark of the beast was on the head and on the hands. So there might be an element, but Brother Chris related it's what she did in her walk and what she did with her talk. And these were evidences against her. And so these, like these remnant parts of Jezebel, it's like an evidence against her. All right. Very good. Ruth.
Just that verse 37 at the end, so that they shall not say this is Jezebel, so that they, it's like she's burned with fire in Revelation 17. It's like that's the end. And the only thing left is the smoke of her burning, which will be forever. And in Revelation 19, it says the beast is thrown alive into the lake of fire.
And here in a nice twist, instead of being burned, she's the excrement of the dogs that ate her on the hills. And that's how she'll be looked at, as nothing but dung in a memory. Okay. Back to our Revelation 17. The flesh is eaten. We saw in the picture the body is removed of the religious order as a society. And she is naked. She's stripped of all that we had read about in verse 3, 17, 3. A woman, verse 4, Revelation 17, 4. She was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, decked with gold and precious stones. All that glory is gone. She's naked, exposed to her shame. They eat her flesh. She's destroyed, consumed by the very people she had once duped. And, she's burned with fire. So that just as like with those bundled tares being burned, showing that denominations being consumed as nominally Christian, the individuals will come back in the restitution. But nonetheless, she's destroyed, and the fire shows the completeness thereof as the friends have well brought out. So when we come to our verse 17, for God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will and agree and to give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God should be fulfilled. So you remember 2 weeks ago we had mentioned that this was so startling that this reminded us of Ezekiel 38 when the Lord put his hooks in the jaw of Magog's host and brought them down to Israel to punish them and destroy them, and that he would be magnified. And so here the Lord is saying, it looks like this was Satan's great attempt to unify Babylon one more time under this eighth head. But lo and behold, it was of my grand design to allow that so they could be utterly destroyed and exposed once and for all. And that will then give glory unto God when the truth is finally made known. And then verse 18 close out. The woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigned over the kings of the earth. So once again, it makes our connection linked like we had back in verse 5. Upon her forehead was the name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, the abomination of earth. So are there any other comments here on Revelation 17? Okay, so I'm not seeing anything offhand. We're going to say very good. That closes this closes out our side study on heads and horns. You could see why we needed to go through the 17th chapter after all our previous considerations, because this is really the definitive chapter for Revelation of understanding how these heads and horns work and how they interact. So that, Lord willing, our next Revelation study, we will start again back where we did in Revelation 13, verse 1. If you have a chance to read in the fourth volume forward, the 1912 long forward, he does a lot of explanation of these symbols there, as well as in the second volume. But nonetheless, that's where we'll pick up, Lord willing. So with that, brethren, we bid adieu to our brethren who will be leaving for the second hour study, our brother from Toronto, Lord bless, and we'll see most of you, we hope, Memorial evening, next Tuesday, and we'll close here with a hymn, and
Brother Chris has his hand up.
Brother Chris.
I've got 10:53. Anyway, I just wanted to ask before we completely depart from the, we've talked about a good many things regarding the heads and the 10 horns through this whole thing. And, when we look at the various brethren who have compiled lists, I don't know if you put forth or suggested which one of those lists you like better. We got Brother Frank Chaloux has a list of what those heads are. He starts with Imperial Rome in 313, and Brother Gene Burns has what he calls the Undivided Empire, Rome of 313, they're the same. But Louisville starts theirs with Justinian's Rome in 539. So
I did put forth the heads list. I sent it out in an email to everybody, and we've been discussing it over the last couple of weeks in part. I'm going to let you finish your comment, but we did put one out, yeah.
Oh, I must either not receive that email or got moved to the wayside. Okay, well, I'll look for that. Cindy may still have it.
Well, Sister Cheryl, what date was that? You looked it up last week or so. You got it on mute.
I will look it up and put it in the chat.
Okay, thank you. But Brother Chris, I didn't mean to cut you off completely. Please go ahead and finish your comment. There's time.
No, that's fine. I was just wondering, they're all similar. They just have different wordings and stuff. But
yes.
Brother Marion Schrock, he starts his way back in 753, and I think we all agree that you have to have the papal system at least influencing in some degree. Whether it's 313 or 539, they gotta be present to have some influence. So, all right, I'll look for that list and see which one sizes up best. Thank you.
Thank you. I sent it out at the very beginning of our heads and horns sub-study. So it's quite a ways back, nonetheless. But I'll say it here. Wait a minute, I think I'm going to be superseded by Brother David and then Sister Debbie, and then we'll be out of time.
I have a note that says January 20th, 21.
Okay.
But it could have been the 21st, too.
Okay. Very good. Sister Debbie?
Sister Wincy just put the file in the chat.
Okay, good. Thank you. Sister Cheryl?
It was January 21st.
Okay. Thank you. So, I didn't accept a premise on each of the 8 lists that I have here in my home that I've considered over the years. I had a problem with each one. And so I put together and offered what we did on that email, all as a suggestion. We're not dogmatic, but in this 17th chapter, we were trying to describe why we thought it was the way we had it. The one is that the woman sat on the 7 mountains so that the, as you said, Chris, Brother Chris, the papacy, the false harlot woman was in existence, even if she wasn't on the beast. She was in existence during the time of these 7 forms of government. And we use Revelation 12 as an example that the great red dragon had 7 heads and 10 horns, but we were viewing it at the tail end of the Roman Empire, the first nominal Christian aspect of the Roman Empire. So that became our first head. The papacy was there in its infant stage, and Constantine was influenced by the church leadership. So they didn't control the empire. They weren't riding the beast or the dragon, but they were there in existence. So that's where we started our head, was all. But I have to say, Brother Russell has a headless 8th beast. The 8th beast is headless. He has that as a comment, but he got that from an earlier writer. If you look back in the early reprints, I think it might have been Brother William Mann. And you look back there, and to my mind, he's just making a connection to the French Revolution based on Revelation 11, which we've already discussed. We studied that. And I don't accept that, never did, because a headless beast is a dead beast. What animal can have its head cut off and be alive? There is none. And there's nothing in this verse that says we should look for a headless beast. That's all developed by Brother Mann. Brother Russell makes a passing comment on that. But if the 8th is of the 7, and we had 7 heads, it confirms that our 8th is going to be a repeat head. So that flies contradictory to a lot of different of our fine, fine brothers' revelation notes. But we never did accept that. And we aren't the only ones, but on that. But all right. I really did talk too long.